Okay, so this is week number 4 of the Navigating Shulvim workshop with Avi Tenenbaum. If you have any questions and you're listening to this by the recording, email me, avitenenbaum9@gmail.com. Okay, so I'm really winging it this week because unexpectedly, something that was supposed to happen on Wednesday happened this morning, and during this presentation I had to go to, I was writing this during the presentation, which was a really sticky situation. So there's a lot of boxes. We're not going to do all of them, probably. We'll do less. Sometimes less is more. I'm happy to give sources for the things that I wrote. I didn't even have time to write them down. But... oh. Right, we're gonna. I'll tell you the sources for that. Just a friend of ours here was talking before we started about practice. You know, the way any of these things will be helpful to us, the week number 1, 2, 3, 4, all the weeks, is practicing any of the stuff that we think might be useful and applying it to our daily life. So I've been giving out the homework papers to help with that. And next week, I hope to, maybe we'll just talk about different cases that are regular situations that people go into, and how to apply the stuff that we did for those situations. And it will be a really nice discussion. I think it'll be really helpful. The tachos of everything is to be able to apply it in the real world, okay? And to learn new skills. Learning new skills is not knowing about something. If you come to this and you hear some idea, so that's kind of like knowing that there's medicine in your closet, okay? But to take the medicine, so we have to practice it. We have to learn it. We have to do something again and again until it becomes second nature and we get used to it. It's just like, you know, maybe somebody could get the door. You know, it's just like, I don't know, I grew up in Chicago and they spoke a lot about Michael Jordan. And Michael Jordan, they would always talk about how he practiced a lot and that's how he became good. Another interesting thing, they did research how many hours it takes to become an expert at something. Okay, so don't be afraid of this number, but it takes 10,000 hours to become a true expert at something. So if you went to your family doctor and he saw a patient so many times that he did this for 10,000 hours, then he probably is a big expert. Okay. Now the Beatles, if people know who the Beatles are, so the reason the Beatles became really good, they admitted, they figured out how do we become so good, is because they couldn't get a job playing music anywhere in England. They were from England, right? And so they decided they were going to move to Germany, and in Germany there was all these like sleazy bars and stuff like this where they always needed musicians, and they would pay them barely anything. They said, we don't care, we just want to practice. And so for many years, they worked crazy. They worked really hard, they put in a lot of hours, they worked in all these little German pubs. And before a few years of time, they got their 10,000 hours, and they became really good. So practicing is what makes you an expert in anything. So if you try something one time or two times or 10 times, I'm not saying you have to wait until 10,000 hours to see results. You can probably see results after much less time, maybe 10 hours, okay? But it's really practicing anything that makes sense to you, bringing it down to the level of action. And if you don't know how to do it, asking me or somebody else, figuring that out, okay? We're going to talk about it a lot next week, but that's the purpose. Okay, so this week, we're going to talk about tools from neuroscience. So let's start with box number 2, and I think we're going to jump around a little bit in the boxes. So box number 2, okay, it says, Reb Zusha of Anipoli said, okay, Reb Zusha was Reb Elimelech of Ujent's, his brother. He said, when I die, they will not ask me why I didn't become Moshe Rabbeinu. They will ask me why I didn't become Zusha. Okay, this is a famous quote. It's such a famous quote, I actually saw this in a Goyesha psychology book called The Spirituality of Imperfection by Dr. Ernest Kurtz on page 1 or 2. But it's known, it's everywhere, it's in Chassidus Sfarim. I'm sure Rabbi Tversky must quote this story 10 times. Okay, so the point of that quote is you have to become yourself. Okay, and that's a big thing that a lot of people are missing is why am I not being successful in overcoming lust and becoming a Talmud Chacham and different things? We're trying to do something that's outside of our capacity or not in our natural way. We're trying to imitate somebody else, but we're not fitting in our own you know, mm-hmm. our own style of doing things and integrating that with what we're looking at. So we're looking at, let's say, the Chavetz Chaim. I'm making this up. Okay, let's say you see the Chavetz Chaim, you see how he davened Shmona Esrei, and you also want to daven Shmona Esrei with Kavanah like him. So, you know, so it's good to emulate the Chavetz Chaim, and you want to watch and see how he moves, and maybe how long it takes for him to daven, and maybe you want to have a conversation with him. But ultimately, we have to integrate how he davened with who we are. Because if we skip that step, we just try to be exactly like him, we're going to be unsuccessful because we're not him. We're different. I'm Avi, he's Chaim, or Yisrael Meir, actually. Right? Okay, we're going to get to this later on, how this is connected to neuroscience. Okay, the next quote here is, in order to overcome lust, you need a lot of patience. Okay, this is in a book that they translated the letters, the Stipler's letters into English about Shmiras HaBrist, and it's called, I think it's called Keep It Holy. What's it called? Keeping Holy? You know what I'm talking about? What do you say?
If he were to name this, he's
I think it's called You Better Keep It Holy. No, I'm just kidding. Maybe You Shall Be Holy. I have it at home. If you want to know exactly what page it's on, I'll tell you, but that's where it is. I did this mamish as I was in another place, like Baal Peh, quickly. Okay, so that's the second quote. Let's go to our third quote. This one I just heard Thursday night, but it's a great one. It is forbidden to judge yourself for having a Yetzer Hara. Okay? We have a Yetzer Hara. Hashem gave it to us. What happens is, if we judge ourselves for having a Yetzer Hara, we get upset, we get shame, guilt, and we fall back into the trap of falling for the Yetzer Hara again. So don't fall for that trap. Don't be upset that you have a Yetzer Hara. It's part of who we are. Okay. Let's look at the next quote. We're going to go into the science behind all these quotes, but I wanted to throw them at you just to show you that our Torah has all the stuff. The Pasuk in Shema says, Hayom al levavecha. Put all these mitzvos today on your heart. Okay, so the Chavetz Chaim, this is famous. There's a liquid from the Chavetz Chaim and the Maseches Brachos. It's like the first piece in there. If you want an exact quote, email me an exact page number. Chavetz Chaim says you have to serve Hashem each day, focusing just on what Hashem wants you to do today, not to be distracted by the past or the future. Okay, it's important to set goals. Let's say you want to become a Talmud Chacham and you want to learn all of Shas. Okay, it's important to set that goal. But if you live all day with that in mind, like I didn't finish Shas yet, I didn't finish Shas, when am I going to finish Shas? That's going to add all this extra baggage. It's going to make it much harder to finish Shas. So the Chavetz Chaim says, set your goal, okay, I want to finish Shas, now put it to the side, and each day, just focus on what do I have to do today. It's one daf a day, so I'm just focusing on this daf, okay? I don't want to distract myself with the past or the future. The past, like, oh, you know, I tried this 10 times and it didn't work out yet. The future, when is it going to happen? I'm getting anxious, when am I going to do this already? Just kind of focusing on the here and now moment. Okay, let's look at the last quote in box number 2, and then we're going to jump in to the rest of the stuff. This is Rav Pinchas of Karit. It's in a Sefer Imre Pinchas, in a section called Shar HaKadusha. It's a really fascinating Sefer with very interesting things. It says, the main kavana of the mikvah, okay, if people here know about kavanos of the Arizal, or of the Baal Shem Tov, you know that when you go to the mikvah, there's all these elaborate kavanos that some people have. So he says something pretty surprising. The main kavana of the mikvah, or any mitzvah for that matter, is I'm going to the mikvah. Okay, if you're learning, the main kavana of learning is I'm learning. Okay, the main kavana of making a bracha is I'm making a bracha. That's the main kavana. People do mitzvahs in order to get somewhere or achieve something, and they forget that the real reason to do this mitzvah here and now is because it's a mitzvah, and Hashem said to do it. You know, Rav Pinchas of Karetz is writing how people are going to the mikvah because it will bring me to this level, it will bring me here, and then I can achieve this, and then I can achieve that. And they're thinking so much ahead in the future that they're missing the present. They're forgetting, no, you know why I'm going to the mikvah? Because Hashem said, it's good to go to the mikvah. Or, you know why I'm making a shahakal? Because Hashem said to make a shahakal. That's the kavan. That's why I'm doing the mitzvah. Is it true that you might find in a sefer, if I make a bracha of shahakal with kavana, it's a segula for Yiras Shamayim, and that will lead to this, and that will lead to that? It's all true. 100% true. But we can't skip over the step of being present here and now for this mitzvah at this moment. Okay? Now, we're going to talk a little bit about meditation today. And we're not going to be talking about meditation that's going to get you nevuah. Okay, we're going to be talking about meditation is therapeutic and helps us to think better. Okay? Let's go to box 3, and I think I'm going to say this Balpe a little bit. Okay? In box 3, so it talks there about, there's something called attachment theory. Okay? And this was discovered many years ago and ignored and fought against for a long time until scientists realized that they were wrong and they admitted that this was the right way of thinking. And what it means is like this. In life, there are many risks and uncomfortable situations that we have to take, right? Like here, I'm talking to this whole big group of people. I have no idea how it's going to work out. It's a risk, right? Or, you know, deciding what time I was going to leave in order to get here was a risk too. Because if I leave early enough, I'll for sure be here. But I left kind of late and there was a risk I was going to come to this place late, okay? There are risks in life. When you're in a relationship, especially when you're married, there are certain risks that you take with other people. You know, telling somebody your feelings, that's a risk. Now, if we feel good and safe, so then we are able to take risks, okay? How do we feel safe? I'll give you an example from a book. I remember this example. Let's say as a child, a big scary dog runs up to you. And he's barking at you, and you're frightened to death that he's going to eat you up, okay? And your mother comes and shoos the dog away and holds you and says, don't worry, I'll protect you, okay? This happened when you were 7 years old. Now, what happened was a scary situation happened, and there was this moment of time in your young age where you have to interpret, like, how do I deal with such a scary situation? Okay, and all of a sudden your mother comes in out of nowhere and she calms you down and she protects you. And what that does is it makes you feel I'm safe, people care about me, I have ways of dealing with scary situations, I can reach out to my mother, you know, and she'll protect me. Okay, and throughout life, whenever something scary or uncertain happens to us, or a risk, and we don't know about the unknown, we don't know what's going to happen next. So if we have a positive experience or some type of way that we feel safe, so it's going to predict we're going to take another risk the next time, you know. If every time I talk to you about something private, you know, and it's embarrassing, but you're able to listen and you're not going to judge me for it, so I feel safe talking to you, and I'll divulge my secrets to you the next time also. But if I tell you, I start telling you, look, you know, I got this problem, I'm drinking, nobody knows about it, I walk out of yeshiva into the bathroom, I have this flask, and I'm just drinking vodka all day, and I can't stop, okay, it's embarrassing. And you judge me, and you look at me funny, and you say, a shikar is a goy, or something, you know? And that's not what I wanted to hear. I wanted you to help me out. And you give me some, you know, deriding comment, okay? I'm not going to feel safe to trust you the next time. And I'm not, and, you know, and now the world is not a safe place. And attachment theory is this idea, that when we feel safe, so then we're able to feel good going further in the future. And if we don't feel safe, then we don't, okay? Now let's move on to box number 4. Now there are two styles, basically two categories that if a person doesn't feel safe about the world, he falls into one of these two categories, okay? One is called, these are terms from a book, this is for Ozzy. There's a book called Bouncing Back by Linda Graham. Amazing book. Anyone can read this book, it's not only for professionals. And this is her terminology, okay? Neural cement. And neural swamp, okay? In your brain, you have all these different cells that help you think, and they're called neurons, okay? So she made up these funny terms, neural cement, as if all your neurons would be like in a cement and you can't move them, and neural swamp, okay? That they're like slashing all over the place. And what it means is like this. If a person doesn't feel safe, so let's talk about neural cement, okay? Neural cement is, he doesn't feel safe, he knows the world is not a safe place, you know. Scary things happens to him and nobody protected him. For example, let's say a person was abused, okay. Let's say a person had some sort of a trauma that happened to him. He was locked in an elevator during a snowstorm for 23 hours, I'm making it up, okay. Sexually abused, physically abused. He was made fun of and bullied in school. There's many examples that probably a lot of people, this is nogea to them personally. And the world is not a safe place. Nobody came in and held their hand and made it that it's okay. Okay, so now they feel the world is not a safe place. So these are two styles a person will jump into. The first one is neural cement, and that means because the world is not a safe place, I'm going to do whatever I can to control everything that goes on around me. Okay? I'm going to learn martial arts and carry a gun, and I'm going to always have an umbrella with me and a thermometer and a parachute, and I'm going to take care of every situation that will ever happen, and I'm going to be a perfectionist. This is another type of doing this, so that I'll never make a mistake and there's no room for anyone to criticize me, and I'm going to become a people pleaser so I can learn exactly what I'm supposed to say to each person. And by doing this, I'm going to avoid every scary situation that ever will come up. Okay? I'm going to turn off my feelings because strong feelings are scary. I'm going to turn off all my emotions. Okay? And this is called neural cement. Their brain is so rigid. Okay? They don't know how to deal with fear. The world is a scary place. Instead of finding ways of coping and dealing with fear, they decide, I won't take any risks, ever. I'm going to arrange the whole show around my life. Okay? It never works out. People that do this usually feel really lonely. They feel depressed. They're never acting genuine. They don't even know themselves. They can't, you know, the emotions that they have always seep in at some level. You can't totally turn off your emotions, and it's scary because they don't know how to deal with them. Being a perfectionist means they're always worried about what people think of them, and they're always worried about every dangerous situation, imaginary situation that comes up, and their life gets totally out of control. Okay? That's neural cement. Their brain is not flexible enough to deal with all types of tsaros that can come up. Okay? So that's one unhealthy style of a person that doesn't feel safe. Now let's look at the opposite style, and that's called neural cement. And that's in the same box in number 4. Neural swamp, thank you. The neural swamp is that a person is totally unpredictable. He's all over the place. Here, I wrote over here, his life is chaotic, he's unorganized. And these people, they never come on time to anything. They make decisions at the last second. They push things off. Okay, so the first person, the guy with the cement in his brain, so they deal with fear by controlling everything as much as they can. The second guy, the neural swamp guy, his brain is a swamp, he deals with fear by running away from it and ignoring it. Okay? You know, the last thing he wants to do is deal with fear because he doesn't know what to do. And he didn't pick the style of organizing everything around his fear. So instead, he's just going to, like, ignore it. And his wife is like, Shmulek, we have to pay the bills. I'll pay and talk to me about it tomorrow. You know, the next day. Shmulek, we have to pay the bill. We'll deal with it tomorrow. Shmulek, the date passed. Okay, how much is the ribbis? It's one shekel a day. Okay, we can wait a week. And he's never wanted to kind of focus and look straight at an uncomfortable thing that he has to deal with and take care of it right now. Because he doesn't know how to do that. Okay? What both of these styles of people have is flexibility. Or resilience. Okay, this is a word I didn't put down, but resilience is a really important word. Resilience is the ability to be able to deal with any type of situation that life throws at you, which requires flexibility. Okay, I never take cabs, ever. Okay, I try to be on time and I try to take the bus. Today, I was so flexible, I was able to take a cab. That's a healthy thing. Okay, I'm not saying you should go take lots of cabs. Today I thought I was going to come late. I took a cab. It was the right choice. So that's something different that I don't usually do, but I was able to use some flexibility to say this is an exception. There's some scary situation. I don't know what to do. I'm afraid I'm not going to come on time. Okay? My brain was flexible enough to come up with a healthy solution. Okay? We need flexibility in our lives, and we need resilience. People that run after lust or video games, movies, alcohol, drugs, or they're very angry and they get very defensive at people, they're either in the neural cement or in the neural swamp. They're lacking a way to deal with life. Life is scary on life's terms. So they use alcohol to get through life. They use pornography to get through life. They'll use anything they can to get through life quick and easy because they don't know a better way. Okay? So this week is very nogea to talking about lust and shogun, because this is mamish the source for why we are in this situation in the first place. Okay? This is kind of like going all the way back to how our brain works and maybe how we can rewire it. Okay? So let's go to box number 5. Okay. So there's something called neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity is a very amazing idea that should give you a lot of chizuk, okay? I really mean it. Neuroplasticity means like this. Any way that you developed your brain until now can be undone and rewired for good or for bad. Okay? A person was born healthy, and then let's say he was, I'm making up the situation, he was sexually abused, and, you know, the family didn't want to expose the perpetrator because it's bad for shiduchim. I'm making up a story that happens all the time. And so here's his, you know, fourth grade Rebbe still walking around, touching the kids in school. And, you know, he knows that his parents know about it, but they're not doing anything. And now the world is not a safe place because the people that are close to me are not taking care of me. And I don't know what to do. This is a scary world. Something scary happened to him. He doesn't know who's going to protect him. So he's got to pick, you know, okay, so I will lust my way through life. I'm going to drink my way through life. Or I'm going to be a perfectionist and arrange everything around myself. You know, always carry a rifle on me so that no one ever touches me again. Whatever it is, okay? Okay? So his brain becomes wired to be very scared and anxious. And he's always worried. Every time he sees, you know, a Rebbe that's like the same height and the same look with the same nefarious mustache, okay? He gets some fear trembling in him. And every time he feels scared in his life, now that he knows it's a scary world, he's, you know, he's always on the edge. And every time he feels anxious, he just starts, playing on Facebook and negating his duties at school and at work. And he's like kind of running away and not dealing with his feelings. And his brain gets wired to make this stronger and stronger, that every time he's nervous, he'll run to a computer and start going on Facebook. Okay? That's neuroplasticity. His brain is getting wired to keep on repeating the idea, the world is a dangerous place, the world is a dangerous place. Your only solution is to go on Facebook. Your only solution is to go on Facebook. And it becomes stronger and stronger. And his brain is mamish wired for this. Okay? That sounds like bad news. Okay? But it's also good news because you can unwire your brain as well. Okay? So now, let's say he wants to start working on himself. We're going to talk about how to do this. And now, he's in therapy, let's say, and he's learning how to rewire his brain in a healthy way. He knows the world was a dangerous place because something bad happened to him. Okay? And now he's trying to find out, instead of running to Facebook when I'm scared, is there something else I can do? Okay? Let's say he finds a healthy thing to do instead. Something that's good to do. And not just a waste of time or not just, you know, an escape. Okay? Let's say it's to meditate for a few minutes, notice how he's feeling, and to tell himself something that's soothing, you know, Avi, you'll be okay, you'll be safe, you know? Or to think about, like, people care about me, you know, if I'm ever in trouble, I know my friends care about me, I can call them up and they'll help me. Whatever the message is, okay? They're going to start rewiring their brain that every time something is scary, instead of running to Facebook, I'm going to run to my soothing thoughts. I'm going to run to my friends. I'm going to run to Hashem. Hashem, I feel so scared. Please help me. Okay? They are rewiring their brain to make a new pattern. And that's very, very possible to do. You can get out of neural cement. You can get out of neural swamp. And you can just make healthy new patterns. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Okay. Let's look at box number 6. Now these are deep things, and that I hope I can explain it in a good way. Okay. The main tachlis stuff is going to come soon, but if you look at 6, let's look at 7 for a second. Okay. Let's look at 7. 7 talks about something called mindfulness meditation. Now mindfulness meditation is not like other types of meditation. There are many types of meditation. If you ever saw books from Rabbi Arya Kaplan about meditation, it has nothing to do with what we're talking about. Okay? If you ever read in Hachsharas Avreichim, or if you looked in the Rebbe of Pizeshne, or in Chabad, they have something called Kuntras Haspalus. There's a lot of types of meditation, and we're not talking about any of them. Meditation for us does not mean that we're trying to get into Olam HaAtzilus. Doesn't mean that we're supposed to feel Dveikus. We're talking about a different type where the goal of meditation here is to think a certain way and to focus on our breathing, to focus on our feelings, and to get in touch with ourselves. It's a totally different goal than the other types that you might have known about. Okay, so let's look at 7. Mindfulness meditation is a type of breathing and thinking exercise that has caught worldwide attention and admiration. It's not new, but over 2,500 years old. originating in the eastern part of the world. However, scientists have been researching it over the last 25 years. They found it to be so effective for a variety of problems that it ranks as one of the top treatment methods for over 20 different mental and physical health problems. Okay? Mindfulness is being universally used all over the world for anxiety, depression, addiction recovery, relapse prevention, which is, you know, making sure that I keep, you know, I'm sober and that I stay sober, chronic pain, you know, people fighting when they're married, marital discord, okay? Bottom of box number 7. It is very simple. Anyone can do it. It's not the knowing. It's not the knowing about what it is that helps you, but the practice of doing it and living by it each day, okay? It has no negative side effects. So we didn't say what it is yet, but we're telling you that it's known in the scientific world. It's extremely popular. It's helpful. And it's a real gift, and I'm happy to tell you guys about it. And maybe if we have time today, we'll practice it. And maybe if we have time, if you guys want the special 8th session that I wrote about, I'm going to try to bring in an expert that can do it with us, okay? I need a backup expert because I think my expert is not going to be here.
We have 8,000 hours.
What do you say?
You only have 8,000 hours.
8,000 hours. Okay. So let's look at the next one, how to practice mindfulness. And that's to the right of the other box there.
We go back to 6?
No. Same page. I think it's box number 8. There's a F on top of the 8. It's hard to see. It's called How to Practice Mindfulness, okay? I think first we'll read it, and then we'll go through some of the stuff, and then we'll try it, okay? How to Practice Mindfulness, okay? This is really easy to do, okay? And then when we have time, maybe we'll listen to it on a recording. Mindfulness is more of a way of living throughout the day, but it's also practiced formally each day as well, so that we can maintain our skill of living mindfully, okay? So, for example, from Hasidus, okay, there's an idea of emunah, and emunah is that, you know, when your bus is late and you're not sure if you're going to make it on time, you should have emunah, right? There's also a formal way of practicing having emunah, which is to go out, talk to Hashem, have a conversation with Him, tell Him all the things you need, speak to Him, tell Him where you're at, and you're believing that He's listening to you, and that would be not just having emunah in the moment, but a formal way of practicing it. And mindfulness is the same way. Mindfulness is going to be something that you can do at any moment in your life, but it's also something that you'll want to practice formally. Okay, so let's look at number 1 in box number 8. Okay, sit on a chair in a comfortable position. You know what, let's even do it now for a minute, okay? Sit on a chair in a comfortable position with your hands. What do you say?
You could open a little bit.
Yeah, it's hot. You can turn on the fan if it doesn't make noise. Thank you, Uri. Okay. Okay, so number 1.
Yeah.
We're going to sit on a chair in a comfortable position with your hands comfortable too. Maybe in your lap. Okay? If you want to hold the paper now, that's fine. Number 2. You can choose to open or close your eyes. I close them. Okay? It doesn't make a big difference. You'll see what the goal is, and then you'll decide if you want to close or open your eyes. Okay? Number 3. Start to notice each in and out breath that you have, okay? You are not trying to relax, and you shouldn't make yourself anxious, but that's not the goal. Nor are you trying to control your breathing. Instead, you are just trying to notice your in and out breaths. That is all, okay? So you kind of want to, you're breathing all the time, and it's subconscious. When we're done with this box, then we'll take a minute and we'll do it, okay? And you're breathing all day. You're breathing when you're asleep. You're breathing when you're talking. You're breathing when you're doing the most difficult tasks. So it's something happening in your subconscious. And what you want to do is step back an inch from your own breathing and notice it. Okay? Now, number 4 is important. As you try to notice your breath going in and out, you'll become distracted by all types of things. Okay? Maybe thoughts, sounds, you might feel uncomfortable, you might be thinking, how long do I need to do this for? Maybe let's get the other fan out and close this. Okay, so as you try to do this, your mind is going to wander away. I guarantee you it will happen to you if you're a normal person, okay? Your mind is going to wander away and you're going to be thinking about you know, am I going to make it on time to yeshiva? Where am I going to daven mincha? I'm hungry. You know, I wish that I could move my leg a little bit to the left. And all these different thoughts are going to come up, okay? Each time that happens, what you do is you bring your mind back to your breath. It could happen 1,000 times in a minute, and that's fine. Just bring yourself back to noticing your breathing going in and out, okay? And let's try that now for a minute again. Okay, let's go through that again. We're just going to sit straight. Okay, we're not talking about some posture that's unnatural, just something that's comfortable. And we can put our hands in our lap. Just get comfortable for a second. And we're just going to, I'm going to clock this for a minute and a half, okay, which doesn't sound like a long time, but I think for some new people it's a long time. And all we're going to do is we're just going to notice our breathing going in and going out. And we're not trying to control our breathing. We're just noticing the breath going in and going out. And there are three ways you can do this. You can do this by noticing the breath coming out of your nose and going in. You can notice it by your belly going in and going out, your stomach, right, your baich. Especially if you have a big baich, that's a good technique. And the other way is your chest kind of rising up and down, okay? I'm going to get to my stopwatch here, and then we'll do this. Okay. Okay, let's go. One and a half minutes right now. Okay, come back. Okay, that was a minute and a half. Did that feel like a long time for anyone or a short time?
Long time.
A long time? Who said, you said a long time?
Sure.
What was it? Long time for you? Okay. Just a quick minute. Did anyone notice anything interesting while they did this? What did you notice, Ari?
Just all the different things that I don't realize are on the wheel that I'm thinking about all day. Just coming up one by one,
So your thoughts were, your brain was kind of out of control, just going by itself.
Mm-hmm. And I get to see what was.
What did you?
Like almost a dream-like experience, more like I don't know, like a play or hallucinations, or like just like falling asleep but not quite asleep.
Okay. Did anyone else notice something interesting at all? What did you notice? You don't want to say. You're not ready to say.
No.
Okay. Israel, anything interesting?
I accomplished not so much in the thought process. I bring myself back so many times. Every single time I went off, my mind was running to 18 million other different things.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, bring it back. But mm-hmm. the amount that I got done or thought about that I could do or should do or would like to do and I'm at, I was able to go back. But it made it clear the step process.
Okay, so it sounds like as you did this for that minute and a half, you noticed that you were telling yourself in your subconscious, I should do this, I could do this, I will do this, and then you brought yourself back. Okay, so there was a lot of like mental conversation going on without you even knowing about it, and you were able to look at it. Okay, so good. So let's talk about that. We're going to get really into this in a few boxes. We're just going to run through a few boxes, and then we'll be ready to mamash sink into this and enjoy it, okay? Let's look at box number 9. Okay. Let's look at box number 9. Benefits of mindfulness. Here are just some of the benefits. Regular mindfulness rewires the brain for better resilience, better coping, less anxiety and fear. Okay. B, it gives you a peace of mind. C, there's a decrease in the impulsivity and reactionary nature to stimuli. So we kind of jump right into things when we're scared, you know, when we react to things. If somebody, we think they insulted us, we react right away, right? We get all defensive and react. So this is a way that we kind of make space in our brain between our reactions and our choice, our free will. Okay? Well, we're going to explain all of this in a second. Okay? Let's look at E. It provides a safe place to go in your mind whenever you feel lost, anxiety, or fear. You can just come to your breathing, or you can go anywhere but your fear. Fear is that I have a certain scary thought, and I'm repeating it again and again and again and again, and I'm not letting go of it. Every second I'm thinking about, how am I going to pay my bill this month? How am I going to pay my bill? He's learning in yeshiva. How am I going to pay my bill? He's in the bathroom. How am I going to pay my bill? And it's repeating itself. Okay? And what makes us have so much anxiety and stress, and what makes it worse, is that because it repeats itself, we're making this network in our brain, this pattern in our brain of fear. We're making our muscle for fear really strong. Okay? People that have pain, by the way, and they think about their pain a lot, they can get something called chronic pain, which is like they've thought about that they're in pain so much that their brain makes a network of pain. It makes a new network of pain. So even when the thing gets healed, they still have pain. Isn't that fascinating? People can have pain for no reason other than they've made a neural network telling them to have pain, but they got healed already. Anytime you think about something a lot, it makes your brain like a muscle that will carry that out. Okay? So another benefit of mindfulness is I can come to my breathing. I can go to, okay, on the way here, I was nervous I'm not going to make it on time, especially before I took the cab that I told you about. Okay? I was able to use mindfulness. Instead of thinking of the thought, I'm going to be late, I'm going to be late, I thought about, I felt my feet touching the ground, and I focused my attention to my shoulders, and I focused my attention to kind of sounds going on around me, and anything else but my fear of coming late. Okay? And that made it that I had a safe place to go instead of my fear. Okay? Let's look at F. Overall improvement of mental and even physical health. Okay? It's been found, like I said, there's research papers of over 20 different things that mindfulness is helpful for. Okay? And G. Improvement of interoception. That's a fancy word, and it's not even in the Word thing in Microsoft Word. It means getting to know yourself really well. Becoming familiar with the nature of your mind, your thoughts, feelings, sensations, and your true self. You can imagine that the more you do this, okay, we did it for a minute and a half. Let's say you do this every day for 25 minutes, okay? Let's say it's not hard for you to do that, and you get to that madriga, okay? You can imagine how good you'll get to know yourself, and you'll be noticing thoughts that pop up, you'll be noticing feelings, you'll be noticing the way your body feels, you'll always be bringing yourself back to your breathing, but something that comes up, you'll notice whatever it is, and then come back to your breath. You can get like a PhD on how you're feeling, and it's so helpful. You can now maneuver your body so much better, your brain, your feelings, you can maneuver through life on such a higher level. It's really amazing. You can become happier because you can begin to notice things, because what are you building is the skill of noticing, right? You're noticing your breath. That's mindfulness, is noticing. You can get good at noticing things in life. And today, I went to a field, and I noticed the grass, and it was really pretty, and I didn't notice it before. It was always there. I was able to notice the green grass, each blade and the color of the green, and it was beautiful, okay? And I got something therapeutic from noticing the grass, okay? I was able to notice the birds. You hear birds all day. You don't notice them. So the better you get at noticing things, okay, the easier it will be to go through life. Your life will become richer. Okay, they use this in marriage counseling because these couples are fighting, and they haven't really had a connection with each other in 20 years. And so John Gottman, who's a famous marriage guy, he says, just notice her. She's making a tea across the room. Look at her for a second. Notice her. Even doing that can save them from divorce. Because like all of a sudden they get this deeper connection without doing anything other than looking at each other and noticing each other. It's fascinating, okay? So life takes on a totally different experience when you start to notice things a lot more, okay? If you can notice better every time you do something good, you'd feel like $1 million. We get depressed because we don't notice the good things that we do. Okay? CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is one of the best treatments for depression, one of the things they do is to try to get you to notice the good things that you do. Okay? So noticing is an amazing door that opens up so many things in our life if we can get good at this. The way to do it is the attitude in general and also practicing it formally. Let's move on to
What does that work about the opposite way as well, noticing negative things?
It's a good question. A lot of people ask, I'm feeling depressed, so you're telling me to notice it. Isn't that going to make it worse? And the answer is no. The reason why is because of box number 10. So check out box number 10. All
right.
No problem.
Isn't depression noticing and obsessing too much on the negative things? We're doing it anyway.
It's true. So look at 10, and you'll see we're going to put a little space in between ourselves and those thoughts. Okay? Box number 10 says, thoughts are much less powerful and real than you think. Okay? If you think about it now, your reality is based on your thoughts, right? You see things, you think about it, and you interpret what it means to you, and then you feel something based on what you thought about. That's how thoughts work. That's how cognitive behavioral therapy works, is that, Shmulek walks into the room, then nobody says good morning to him, and he thinks, what does that mean? Nobody said good morning to me. He thinks about it, and because he thinks about it, so he says, I will interpret this that nobody likes me anymore. Okay, and then he feels worthless. Okay, so thinking is kind of our reality and our window to the world. Now, if we can kind of change the way we think or change our relationship to thoughts a little bit, it could be very helpful. So let's look at 10. A huge revelation from mindfulness skills is that you are not your thoughts. Okay, I'm expecting somebody when I'm done with this box to ask me a question from Chassidus, and if you don't ask it, then you obviously don't know Chassidus that well. But let's finish the box first. I'm expecting you to ask it. He's covering his face. You. Okay? A huge revelation from mindfulness skills is that you are not your thoughts. Your mind's nature is to produce all types of thoughts on the subconscious level all the time, even when you sleep. Okay? Ori said, Azriel said, during the minute and a half, my mind was just chatting away, blabbing. Like, he just wouldn't stop. He was just talking in my ear. Okay? By realizing that you can objectively observe your thoughts and feelings, and you don't have to be inside your thoughts and dragged away by them, you kind of put some space in between you and your thoughts. Okay? A guy, this is a story. Okay? A guy was having a thought, I have this thought, this imagination of robbing a liquor store. Okay? Did I say this story here? Okay? The therapist told me this case. A guy was having thoughts, I have to rob a liquor store. He didn't know why he thought that, but that's what he was thinking. He has to rob a liquor store, and he thought about it again, and he thought about it again, and he thought about it so many times that he came to the conclusion that if he doesn't soon rob a liquor store, he's going to be so anxious, he doesn't know what he's going to do with himself. Okay, so what happened was, he had a thought, and he bought into that thought. He embedded himself, and he like kind of entered and climbed into his thought so much that it became his reality, and it made him so anxious that he thought the only way to relieve myself is to do this. Okay? His therapist gave him a very simple idea to help him with. He said, you are not your thoughts. You have a thought about robbing a liquor store, and it is a thought. You can't deny it. You thought about it. But that's all it is. It's just a thought. It's not anything more than that. Okay? A person can have, they can have an urge to lust, a really strong urge. And they can make the conclusion, because I have this urge to lust, I think that I must lust, and if I don't, something will happen to me. Okay? And the revelation is, it's actually just a feeling. It's not anything more than a feeling. So you can have that feeling and still not lust, because, just because you have it doesn't mean you have to do something about it. You can just notice it, honor it, okay? Don't judge yourself for it. I have this thought to lust, and that's it. That's all it is. It's not anything more than that. Kind of accept it for what it is, but not need to cash into it, step into it and get dragged away from it, okay? People are depressed or people have low self-esteem because they buy into their thoughts so much that they're like a yo-yo. If somebody says something good to me, I feel up. If somebody says something not so good to me, I go down. They're like so connected to their thoughts and the external things that happen to them. So when we do mindfulness, we're noticing my thoughts actually run all the time. Even without me thinking about it, it happens. It's like just my brain is on autopilot. That's what it is. It's just like, it's like a wild horse that runs around and does whatever he wants. Or it's like, some people say it's like a river that just, it keeps on flowing. You can't really even stop it that easily if you want to. You can get a little control over it maybe, but there's nothing wrong with that. The nature of our mind is to say all kinds of funny things, and that's part of who we are. And once we know that, we give less credibility to our thoughts, and then we're able to navigate a lot easier. Okay? I'm not going to buy into my thoughts now every time. I'm going to think about it before I do something. Just because I have a thought to rob a liquor store doesn't mean I have to rob a liquor store. Okay?
A major tenet of Judaism is to change your thoughts as well, obviously. I'm saying not just exterior things.
Very good.
Change your,
So you're asking the question that I hoped somebody would ask. Okay? I don't think it's Chazal, but Sefer Chassidus especially talk about how, you know, you are where you think. So if, you know, even if you're down here and you're not on the highest level, but you're like, Hashem, you know, I wish I can get close to you. I wish I can get out of this, you know, lust situation. I wish I can be tahor and I can serve you properly. You are where your thought is. Okay, that idea is true. And we also want to change our thoughts to have holy thoughts. That's also true. All these things are true. It's not a contradiction. This is how we split it up, okay? The thoughts that I naturally have, because it's subconscious and they're kind of talking to me, and it's like running all the time, even without me trying. Like Azriel said, he did the 1.5 minutes of just sitting there, and he was blabbing away in his mind, okay? Those thoughts we want to accept just for what they are. They're nothing more than our subconscious mind, okay? Our conscious mind, which is where we have lots of control, then we want to do what we can to become tahar, and we want to yearn to get close to Hashem, okay? And we want to change our thoughts as best as we can. But to judge ourselves for having certain thoughts, let's say a beautiful woman comes into the room, and for that fleeting moment, you have some lust thought, you know, being with her, okay? To judge yourself for that wouldn't be appropriate, because that's part of your nature of your subconscious mind. Okay, look in the Gemara Bava Basra, Kuf Samach Dalet Amud Beis, in the Marsha, and he says this idea. Okay, I happen to be writing a paper on this, that's why I remember that. I'm writing a paper about sexuality for therapists that don't know Gemara and stuff like this. Okay, the Marsha talks about, the Gemara says, there are three things that a person is not saved from every day. They will happen to him no matter what. One of them is Hir Hur Aveira, having sexual thoughts. The Marsha says, there's nothing you can do about this because your mind works so fast without your control on it. That's just the nature of what it is. Now, the Iyun Yaakov says, he's in the Ein Yaakov, there's a pirush called Iyun Yaakov, he says, but if you exert a lot of effort, maybe you can change something and move it up a little bit to the next step. And they're both true. So we don't want to judge ourselves for our nature or
who
we are.
What do you mean by move
a
step up?
You know, if I stay away as much as I can from looking at women unnecessarily and from having bad thoughts, I'll probably have less subconscious sexual thoughts. So I don't want to judge myself for the internal conversations that happen without my getting involved in it. But at the same time, I want to do what I can to grow. And it's not a contradiction. Okay? I'm going to skip box 11 and 12 and 13, but they're amazing, so check them out. Okay? Okay, you know what? I'm giving into my Yetzer Hara. Look at 11. Okay? Expand your free will. If you only knew how to jump into that space, just quickly. This is an amazing quote. Look at this quote. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. Okay, meaning between something that happens to me and the way I do something about it, there's a little space, a little gap. In that space lies our freedom and our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our happiness. Okay? Between me seeing the beautiful woman and reacting to that by lusting, there's a tiny, tiny space. Now, a person that's so used to running after lust, it's a very tiny space. For a person that he's not so used to running after lust, it's a little bit of a wider space. But there is a space there, okay? And if you can know how to kind of get into that space and do something during that space, okay, I know I'm talking in kind of esoteric terms, that's where you can kind of expand your free will. Meditation does that because we're learning how the nature of our mind, and we're learning to kind of understand what are our reactions and to notice them, what are our thoughts, what are our feelings, and we're kind of stepping into that space and becoming an expert at getting in there, okay? And so we can actually expand our bechira chafshus, our free will, by doing this type of stuff, okay? Look at box 12. The range of what we see and do is limited by what we fail to notice. And because we fail to notice that we fail to notice, there's little that we can do to change until we notice how failing to notice shapes our thoughts and deeds. Okay? You can't change something unless you notice that you need to change it. And if your problem is that you don't notice things that you need to change, then you'll never change them. So you first need to notice things that you need to change in order to change them. Okay? So noticing opens up doors to a lot of things.
Sorry, how is all this different from innate health?
From?
Innate health. Innate health.
Yeah. What is that?
It's like three principles and stuff.
Oh, the three global principles?
Yeah.
Of
Mind, consciousness.
I don't know anything about it. I just get their web. I get these like YouTube videos from them like 5 times a week. But I don't know anything about that system.
Okay.
I try to find out about it, and they seem to have nothing in print. They just have hundreds of videos. Okay, but I know what you're talking about. I know somebody that practices that. Okay, let's go to box 14. And I know we're running low on time, so I'm going to be real short. Okay. Here are two words from Buddhism, okay, but there's nothing inherently Buddhist about these words. That these are pretty important words, okay? One word is grasping, another word is pushing, okay? When you start to cultivate mindfulness and you start to notice your thoughts when they come up, you'll notice all the time we're grasping for things. I want this, I want this, I want this. I want that woman. I want a hamburger. I want to feel good. I want to finish this daf gemara. Okay? We're grasping all the time. Grasping, grasping, grasping. Another thing we're doing is pushing. Okay? I don't want to learn with him. Okay? I don't want to be his roommate. I don't want to be feeling this way. I don't want there to be... They used to call it this thing in the yeshiva, tuna baluna. It was the worst thing they served for supper. I don't want tuna baluna. Okay? We're either grasping for things or pushing. Now, if you want to begin to work on your midos, it's a great place to start by noticing every time that you're grasping for things and every time that you're pushing. How could you work on your taiva if you don't realize when it comes up, how often it comes up? That's the box that we just read about, failing to notice. If you don't notice the things you have to change, then you can't change them. Okay? So in Buddhism, when they do this type of meditation, they talk a lot about those two words, grasping and pushing. So one thing you can do is, you can be mindful in your day. Every time you want something, notice that you're grasping. Every time that you don't want, notice that you're pushing it away. Okay? Even that can open up a door for you. Okay? When you're sitting for 5 minutes and you're doing formal meditation, and those thoughts come up, the internal blabber that he's just talking in your ear, notice how many times you want things and how many times you don't want things. Okay? That's box 14. Okay, now I don't know how we're going to get through the next 7 boxes in a short time, but let's try. Okay? These are 7 traits that are amazing, amazing, and I encourage everybody to read each box carefully after we leave here. There's big stuff in these boxes, okay? This is taken from a book called Full Catastrophe Living from John Kabat-Zinn. Z-I-N, okay, because I know Azriel likes to know, and it's in there, these are 7 traits that you want to get good at these traits before you do mindfulness meditation, during and after. You'll see what they are right now. Trait number 1 is non-judging, okay? Non-judging means I notice that I really love hamburgers. I'm a huge Baal Taiva for hamburgers, okay? I notice that because I'm doing my mindfulness meditation. I'm becoming more mindful in my life. I'm noticing things. I'm noticing sounds. I'm noticing feelings. Don't judge yourself for that. Okay? We brought a makor in box number 2 for that from the Chazal, okay? From Chassidus. But, okay? Don't judge where you are. Okay? Okay, you're about time now. Accept it. But you want to grow. Okay? Don't bash yourself in the head for that. That's non-judgment. Okay? So if you notice, I have lust, I have lust, I have lust, don't judge yourself for that, okay? You have to work on it. You have to grow. You have to do whatever you can to grow because that's what you want to do. You want to get close to Hashem, okay? But don't bash yourself in the head. Oh, my gosh, I have sexual thoughts. I must be a pervert. I must be bad. Bash, 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 okay? Doing that is judgment. Don't judge yourself. Non-judging. That's trait 1, okay? Let's look at trait number 2 in box 16. Patience, okay? We brought from the stipler, if you want to work on lust, you have to have a lot of patience. It's not going to happen every day, okay? Patience, it's the same thing. We're noticing things, and now we're noticing the things we have to change. We have to have patience. Not everything happens right away. That's just the way it is, okay? An example they give in books a lot of times is a butterfly, okay? If you try to open up the cocoon in the middle, you're going to see this weird skinny bug, and he's probably going to die. You have to wait till he goes through all the process. I forgot the fancy word for that, but, and he becomes a butterfly. What's the fancy word? What is it?
Metamorphosis?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, if you open up the cocoon in the middle, you're not going to get a butterfly. There's nothing to do but to wait. Absolutely nothing. The same thing is true with recovery. The same thing is true with feeling sad. The same thing is true with being a Talmud Chacham. You have to wait. And so just be mindful of that idea. Okay? So if a judgment thought comes up, I can be mindful of the judgment thought and say, I'm going to be non-judging. If a thought comes up of like, you know, let's get this over already. When am I going to get better? I'm going to do mindfulness and get better. Patience. Yeah.
Is non-judging here coming back to the Buddhist and Taoist tradition, or is this actually an English speaker choosing this word on his own?
What do you mean?
Because the thing is that whenever we look at Asian theologies or whatnot,
mm-hmm.
is when we have the word non in the translation, non-something,
mm-hmm.
non-knowledge is the way that a rabbit will go and hop, while to go and know the mechanics of how the rabbit hops is knowledge.
Okay.
And the thing is that we're not supposed to go and know, or judgment here is bad, but there is a level of judgment to know that, okay, here's what the actual essence is.
Exactly.
And so that's one of the things that I'm not sure is if we're referring to an Eastern tradition of non-judgment or Western, is where I don't judge, period, is
that's
that
it.
You're
uh-huh.
taking yourself totally out of the situation where you're not even thinking about
Okay.
Which one are we looking at in this case?
Okay. This is, it's all coming back to Buddhism, and these are the words of John Kabat-Zinn, who
okay.
they took it and brought it down into the clinical realm, so it's not connected to religion, but if you look at the words that I wrote in each one of these boxes, it's taken almost literally from his book.
Okay.
So, you know, if I maybe I should have spent more time on this, because this is the real meat, okay, and you should really read these boxes carefully. There's a lot of stuff in them, but you'll get all your insights about what it means, each thing exactly, by reading all the words carefully. Okay, I tried to copy his words, okay? So the first one is non-judgment, okay? Don't bash yourself in the head for something that you notice. Number two is patience. If you notice, I want to be, you know, I want to get this over already, so be mindful of that. Just notice it, and remember the trait of patience. Number three is beginner's mind. Beginner's mind is amazing, and that is we want to cultivate a mind that's willing to see everything as if it's for the first time. Okay, I never did this before. This is the first time that I'm doing this. This is the first time that I'm saying Kriya Shema. Okay, like why don't we do Shmona Esrei with a lot of Kavanah? Because I did it yesterday and I did it the day before. I didn't have Kavanah yesterday and I'm not going to have it today, right? We kind of project what we're going to do now based on what we did before. And beginner's mind says, no, today is a totally new day and a new moment. It never happened before. This is a new Shmona Esrei and a new opportunity. This is a new Avi or a new Shmulek, whoever we're talking about. And everything is new, okay? The same thing with mindfulness meditation. Each time I sit down and do 5 minutes of meditation, it's brand new. It never happened before, okay? And we want to have, you know, in Torah we call this a lot of times Hischadshus, okay? We want it to be that each new moment is a new moment, okay? Because we get stuck. We don't succeed a lot of times in doing the right things because we're basing it on what happened before. So now we're saying, no, beginner's mind. I'm doing this new for the first time, okay? Number four is trust. And trust is learning how to trust ourselves. Because what happens when we do mindfulness is that we get to learn a lot about ourselves. We notice our body, and we notice our thoughts and our feelings, okay? And all of a sudden, we kind of meet ourselves for the first time in a new way that we never knew ourselves before. And it's really fascinating, okay? You might think that you're used to knowing your body, okay? If you would do one body scan for mindfulness meditation, which is a different way of doing mindfulness, you would feel like you were just born out of the womb and like you don't even know this body. It's absolutely amazing. And I hope, if Bezrat Hashem, maybe I could bring somebody the 8th week to do all the stuff with us, okay? If you can fully notice your body and notice your limbs, it's a totally new life experience. You can live in your body. It's amazing, okay? And so trust is about trusting yourself and getting in touch with yourself. I'm going to listen to my Rebbe. I'm going to ask my Rav for advice, but I'm going to integrate that with myself. Right? I don't want to ask him advice about you. I'm asking him advice about me. So I have to make sure it fits in with who I am. So you want to have an attitude of trust when we're doing mindfulness. We might notice some thoughts or feelings while we're doing meditation that, you know, that we can notice it and say, yeah, that's part of who I am. That's part of where I'm holding. These are my thoughts. These are my feelings. Okay? This is me. This is my mind. Okay? Trust. Let's go to 5. 5 is non-striving. Non-striving is amazing. And this is kind of like the quote we said from the Chafetz Chaim in box number 2. Non-striving is that, you know, people a lot of times are doing things in order to get to the next place, in order to get here, in order to get there. And they skip over living in the present moment. Okay? I want a master's degree so that I can become a doctor, so that I can become famous, so that I can make money, so that I can sit at home and learn a lot, okay? Whatever it is, I'm making it up, okay? You know, I want to learn so that. And instead of all the so that, I just want to do this now and experience this in this moment for what it is, okay? Non-striving doesn't mean I shouldn't make goals. You should make goals and you should have she'ifos and you should yearn. All those things are spiritual and they're good. But not striving is that, you know, when trying to get to the next place is distracting me from what I'm doing right now, then that's not good. Okay? I want to focus right now on davening Shmona Esrei, this time, at this moment, with Kavana, regardless of whether, you know, I will build up tomorrow and it will be better, and the day after that will be better. Those thoughts will distract me from right now, in this moment, davening Shmona Esrei with Kavana. So non-striving is to be present in this moment right now for what this is, and not to let the future distract me, okay? 6 is acceptance, and acceptance is, okay, if you look in box 20, a few lines near the end, it says, acceptance does not mean you have to be passive about things and abandon your ability to make changes. Acceptance simply means to be willing to see things actually as they are, instead of pretending that it really isn't, okay? Acceptance is just accepting the reality of the situation, okay? Instead of, a lot of times, you look at the box, it's an amazing box, and it's talking about how people are, you know, people a lot of times, they spend their life denying things and resisting things, and it wastes so much of their time and resources instead of just accepting what this is and then figuring out what to do about it, okay? A person, I'm going to make up an example. Let's say a person has a really big anger issue. And everyone tells them, like, you know, you fly off the handle all the time. It's not enjoyable to be with you. Nobody wants to be your friend. And he's spending every moment that he can denying it and resisting it and arguing back. And you can be sure by doing that, he's never going to work on it. Okay? He probably won't do it forever. But if he does that for 2 years, he's going to waste 2 years of working on himself. So when we are doing mindfulness and we're noticing things that we see about ourselves, we want to accept it for what it is, for the reality of what it is. And 7 is letting go. That's box number 21. Okay? And that's talking about, look at the bold in the very bottom of that box. Here, example. There's an example and then we're going to finish with this. Letting go is what we do each night when we go to sleep. When people are thinking too much while they try to go to sleep, it's a sign that they're too involved or attached to their thoughts. Forcing yourself to sleep makes it worse, right? Can you force yourself to sleep? There's no such thing. You have to kind of let go. So by practicing mindfulness, we detach from our thoughts a little bit by letting go. Okay, we don't completely detach from our thoughts because we'd be psychotic, but we're putting a few inches between our thoughts and ourselves. And that gives us the ability to be in a centered and healthier place and not to be dragged along with our thoughts and our feelings, okay? Instead of every time I feel sad, I get schnepped off to pornography, and every time I feel good, I get schnepped off to drinking or bragging about myself, I'm going to put a little bit of space in between me and my feelings or between me and my thoughts, and I'm going to let go a little bit. Sometimes we like to hold on to certain feelings, okay? I wrote something last week. Okay, and 2,700 people saw it. It was like on this listserv of professionals. And I identified too much. This is admitting a mistake. I identified too much with my ego and with what I wrote. And I was really worried that some bigwig doctor somewhere is going to argue with me on some kutzo shalyud, some little thing that I wrote, and then everyone's going to see it, and I don't know what, okay? I over-identified with the post that I put there, and I was thinking about it, and I was ruminating about it, and thinking, what happens if somebody disagrees with me? What if I really made a clinical mistake? What if this? What if that? And what I need to do is let go. Just let go of that thought. Okay? You're identifying too much with your ego, too much with your thought. Let go of it. There's an amazing book. Okay? Use your discretion if you're going to look into this book. It quotes a lot of stuff from other religions. And okay, I'm not saying you should ever look at it or get into it. And I don't want to get in trouble for anyone doing anything funny. But there's a guy named Eckhart Tolle, T-O-L-L-E. He writes some of the most amazing things about this type of idea, about over-identifying with our ego. I'll finish with a story from him, actually. He was hired as, or I don't know if he was hired, but he was asked by a woman who was dying from cancer to help her die peacefully. Okay, he's like a pastoral counselor, and he's big into meditation, not mindfulness meditation, but similar. And he talks a lot about these things. And this lady was in the last weeks of her life, and she was an only child. She had no family, and she had a ring that she inherited from her grandmother. Okay, this was her whole connection to her lineage and her past. And the caretaker, that you know, there was like this, you know, lady that was hired to help her go to the bathroom and to move around, and a caretaker. She thought the caretaker stole her ring. She couldn't find the ring anywhere. She was bedridden. She couldn't get out of bed to look for it, but they had people look for it. They could not find this ring, and it was very meaningful to her. And she was so depressed, and this was like 3-4 weeks before she was going to die. She was so depressed that she couldn't find this ring. And Eckhart Tolle said to her, "Let me ask you a question. In 4 weeks, you're going to die, and you're not going to have this ring anyways, okay? So maybe you would like to think about how you identify with this ring. How much are you attached to this ring? And if you can change your relationship with it a little bit. You know, instead of being so connected to this ring that I can't even live the last 4 weeks of my life peacefully, maybe you can reframe the way that you, you know, view your connection to that ring and see if you can live more peacefully the last 4 weeks of your life." And so they spoke about this and they did that. And it was just an amazing idea. Like, after 4 weeks, she was going to die, and she anyways wasn't going to have the ring. You know, and that's kind of like what it says in Tehillim. I think it's in Perek Mem Tes, and it talks about Al tira ki yashir ish, right? You know that pasuk? And it says, don't worry if you see a really rich guy. He's going to die. He's not going to bring it all with him. Our attachment to avdat sometimes is too much, or to our ego. Okay? We want to put a little bit of space between that and our life. Okay, if anyone wants, for 5 minutes, we can do mindfulness meditation. If not, not. I'm going to end here, but I'm going to start the recording. Okay, you guys can go if you want to stay. Then I'm going to press the recording and we'll do mindfulness. Okay, I'll give a second for people to leave.